Good evening. That sounds pretty good to me. Sounds good to Patty. So this is the last of three classes that we've had. I'm not to call them a class because in truth I have mostly lectured. Because there's, and in this case, I think that was appropriate because there's a lot of terminology in the Yogacara school that I'm guessing most of you were unfamiliar with or had at best a passing acquaintance with prior to me talking about them. So I will again, review briefly that the Yogacara school is called the Yoga Practice School. That's the translation of Yogacara, Yoga Practice. It's known for its teachings that are called mind only or representation only. The idea being that the way we know experience is through the way we conceptualize experience, the way we know experience in the mind is the most important thing to pay attention to it. And in fact, more than that, that's really the only way we do know is through the representation of sense phenomena conceptualized in the mind. So the last time we talked about the eight consciousnesses of the Yogacara school, and that's the five sense consciousnesses, which are common to every school of Buddhism, and what then, plus three, that Vasubandhu, who's considered the founder of the Yogacara school, calls three transformations of mind. So the sixth consciousness for Buddhism is mind consciousness. And according to this Yogacara school, that consciousness has three transformations, three ways it can appear, three manifestations. So those three transformations of mind are called the storehouse consciousness, or the alaya vijnana. And the second one is called the afflicted consciousness, or manas. And the third is called, and this is in reverse order from 8 to 6. So storehouse consciousness is the eighth consciousness in the Yogacara system, the manas is the, or afflicted consciousness is the seventh, and then mind consciousness, which would be common to all Buddhist schools, is the sixth, as it is for all Buddhist schools. So these are three transformations of mind, and I said that the storehouse consciousness is considered the image. Is like a granary, however you say that, and a place where seeds are grained or stored. And in this case, what's being stored is karma. So in this version of this storehouse, the seeds, they're called seeds, of karma are stored, and the seeds that are stored can be wholesome karma and unwholesome karma. And today, and when we experience things that arise in consciousness that we don't feel that we had any agency for. Okay, when there's no sense of agency, that when something just comes up, and I often use anger. can arise in an instant, in just a, you know, it's almost like a, I don't know, it's a fireworks, it's something that just goes off. And we often have a sense of, where did that come from? What happened? Where did that come from? And so the idea would be in this school, they would say, well, that was a seed germinating, fructifying in the Alaya. And that's where it came from. So we would identify this with, like, today with the subconscious, the idea of a subconscious mind, a mind that we can't see, yet we know, most everyone can tell, there are forces within them. There are things happening within them that don't seem to be under, you know, conscious control or under the influence of conceptualization. They just arise out of this storehouse, according to this teaching. So the sixth consciousness, or the second one in the three transformations, is manas, or the afflicted consciousness. And this is something that the Yogacharans came up with to explain our strong sense that we have a self. We believe that there is an entity in, I mean, we're constantly taught no entity, right? No essence, no self. But we always know this flies in the face of our everyday experience. When we get up in the morning, we think, I get up out of bed, or I don't get up out of bed. So we go around most of our days thinking that there is entity-ness. I mean, we assume it. It's hard to, if we're honest, it's hard to deny that we don't have this kind of feeling. So the theory in the Yogacara school is that, according to the teaching of this mentality, this mentality looks into the granary, it looks into the storehouse, and it sees a self there. And so but because this is a Buddhist teaching, any consciousness that sees a self is a consciousness in error, a consciousness in ignorance. What was the word you were going to use?
Delusion.
Very good. And finally, manovijñana, or the conceptualizing consciousness, is the consciousness that is rooted in sense experience and assigns words and conceptual constructions to our experience. So this is pretty much, you know, again, like sort of a standard Buddhist understanding of mind consciousness. It's the conceptualizing consciousness that in which images appear in the mind and get immediately assigned a designation. So that's, and I think we have an understanding that language is, that images and language are, you know, something that we need to account for. And so the Yogacharans account for it, as really does all of Buddha's teaching.
I missed something. Is this last consciousness?
Do you want to get the mic?
Is the last consciousness you're speaking of mind consciousness or manas? Number six or seven?
Say it again. In there.
Is the consciousness you're speaking of that explains, that is rooted in sense experience and assigns words and concepts, Manas or?
Manovijnana.
Manovijnana.
Manovijnana. The sixth consciousness of all Buddhist schools. Mind consciousness.
Mano versus manas.
Mano, yeah, versus with the O, mano, vijnana. Right. Versus manas, which doesn't have a vijnana behind it for some reason. I don't know why.
Thank you. And ancillary question. Which of these consciousnesses is sometimes referred to as karmic consciousness?
That would be manas. Well, it's hard to say. That's a good question. I mean, karmic consciousness is also called active consciousness. It's hard to see how all these aspects of consciousness aren't in some way active in karmic consciousness. I mean, Alaya Vijnana is the repository of karmic seeds, but it takes, you know, it has this aspect of, but it's based on, really, how do the karmic seeds get there? It's based on sense experience, it's based on all our experience, it's based on, according to traditional teaching, past lives and so forth. And then you have this aspect that's looking in, you know, the manas is looking into the Alaya and seeing a self there. So, which part is karmic consciousness? Maybe all of it. Maybe all of that is the process of karmic consciousness that has to be, that is, in Reb's book, he says that the process of really what our practice is about is transforming the Alaya. So you know the trans essentially transforming our karma. So in that sense, I guess we would kind of point a lot to the Alaya in terms of talking about karmic consciousness, because if we're gonna, you know, he says that's where we have to get down. That's where we have to get to that level in order to. Purify our consciousness.
But the activity of creating
new karma, continually creating new karma, is a function of manas. Manas, that is, activity premised on manas. View on manas is delusion.
Well, no, I actually would think it's more the activity of creating new karma is based on in a sense like manas is just making a mistake all the time. But I don't know that if it's creating new karma, it's just seeing karma as a self, or it's seeing the fructification of the seeds in the Alaya as a self. But it really is the active consciousness, the manovijnana, that is actively engaged with sense experience all the time,
right,
and is conceptualizing that sense experience, and acting. On the other hand, manas is according to Reb's teaching on it is you know what sees an eye, which is the biggest mistake you can make, and if you look into the storehouse and you see, you know, what's coming up out of there as a self, that certainly is creating more karma as well. So I don't know that I don't think I've directly experienced this. But I would say that it is, you know, I mean, we say, you know, karmic creation is karma is action, right? And what really does action is conceptualization of our experience. I mean, the way that we define and think about what we are sensing. You know, first you have just sense experience, but then if we react, you know, in various ways to sense experience, then we're being creative. So I think in that sense, you know, just active, regular consciousness is creating more consciousness, more karma, excuse me.
So perhaps we could say they're all involved in the process of karmic recreation, but it's mano vijnana that is most instrumental, let's say, in the immediate activity of karmic, of creating karma.
The one thing I do remember now is that the 30 verses say that the alaya is neutral.
Right.
So the alaya is neutral. So it's not involved in actually creating more karma. It's just a storehouse. It's neutral. It isn't involved in an active process of creating karma. So we can rule out the alaya, and I think we can. You know, if we just use common sense, I think that we can look at the way we, well, first of all, the experience we have and the way we think about that experience and the way we act on the basis of that conceptualization of that experience as what creates karma. I mean, that, you know, it is our action. And our action is, you know, seeing a person and saying, you know, woman, tall, some skin color, you know, something, you know, we're making these conceptualizations all the time, and some of those conceptualizations we make over and over again, and they're why we make them is probably because of our, you know, past karma. And when we make them again, it's creating more. Every time we make that kind of conceptualization, that kind of categorization, that kind of prejudicial conceptualization, we create more of the same. That seems to be how it works.
Tim.
Oh, okay. You've got the mic, and then Doralee.
I just wanted to, at least from my studies with Linda Cutts on karma, I don't know which category this would go into, but, you know, you said transforming karma.
Transforming the alaya was what I was speaking about.
Oh, okay. Just, I mean, but...
Oh, the three transformations, you mean?
The actions that we take, the new actions that we take can be, you know... making things worse by adding to the pile of unwholesome deeds, mm-hmm. or they can be wholesome deeds, which then do transform those unwholesome things in the storage that we did before. And so that, I mean, and then if we don't have a fixed self, if we understand that, then we can understand that those past deeds aren't us. I mean, we have the freedom to, or the choice to create new karma that is more wholesome.
Yeah, and another thing that I was thinking about is that, you know, we often talk about, you know, it's clear that. It is our in meditation practice that we transform the alaya, and part of that is just sitting and letting what is ripening ripen, and feeling whatever that, you know, feeling the, oftentimes for me it seems like it's painful, what is ripening seems painful to me. But it doesn't always have to be that. Could be joyful, could be neutral, could be, you know, either of those three things. But, you know, I don't want to get into this idea that, like, you know, we have like this much wholesome karma over here and this much unwholesome karma over here, and if we make more of this, then the weight will go down on this side of the scale. The little bit more feeling that I have is that we just sit still and let and see karma ripening and let it ripen and absorb its ripening. And part of that non-action related to that is what really is healing. So, Dorley.
I don't know. I just thought maybe I could give an example in my own practice to kind of get it more concrete, because this happened a couple of weeks ago. I was kind of in a conflict with my daughter, and I thought that I expressed myself in a kind of kind way, just saying that, you know, I wished that the situation had been different. And then I was sitting on my pillow, and then all of a sudden I could feel this sort of tightness in my jaw, and I could suddenly see that this nice way I thought I had spoken actually had a kind of digging anger in my voice tone. So it felt sort of like it was sort of shocking to see that, but my practice sort of shined the light on this, and then it was like, yeah, I was kind of passive-aggressive in that moment. And then I got really excited that I had this insight about myself. And then I was like holding on to this, sort of like a new self-identity, you know. And then when I was like really getting this whole thing about letting go of self, it was like, oh, now I need to let go of that. It's like I'm aware of it and already something's changed. But if I hold on to that, then I'm not going to see what's now arising between my daughter and I. So then when I noticed what was arising between us, something had really changed. So I don't know. That just feels like an example of what you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
That even what arises in our practice is sort of like maybe even an insight, but then we can make that into a self too.
Right.
And
right.
So we let go, and then the seeds can arise again. So, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, if we have an insight and then we stake a claim in our insight, then, you know, it's a little bit more of the same.
And then we stop the process of this transformation.
Oh, you didn't take the mic to say something. Okay. So, well, looks like it wants to be a class now. Okay, so maybe it'll be like that tonight. But the reason that I've been bringing these teachings out, I mean, I didn't have a totally clear conception of what I was going to do in this 3 weeks. But what became clear to me is that what I wanted to do was give the background from the Samdhi Nirmochana Sutra that would then make Vasubandhu's 30 verses more intelligible to you. Because I thought later on, probably in the fall, that we would get that book. I had this idea that you would get this book, 30 verses, Vasubandhu's 30 verses, or I think it's called Vasubandhu's Yogacara by Ben Colvin. And you would take it to the beach with you this summer, and you would just enjoy that summer reading. And but when you did that summer reading, you would say, "Oh, yeah, I know what he's talking about." So that's kind of the point. Because listen to the first verses, the first two couplets of Vasubandhu's 30 verses. Everything conceived of as a self or other occurs in the three transformations of consciousness. The ripening of karma, the consciousness of a self, and the imagery of sense objects. The ripening of karma, the alaya, the consciousness of a self, manas, and the imagery of sense objects, mano-vijnana. The first of these is called alaya, the store consciousness which contains all karmic seeds. What it holds and its perception of location are unknown. Very interesting. So I think you would read that now, those first verses of the 30 verses, and based on these talks, you would have some sense of, because I think if you just read those cold, although Ben Colvin does a very good job of giving you, his book is probably much more, I don't want to say basic, but he's good at putting these teachings in plain English. He doesn't bring in too many of the Sanskrit words. I probably burdened you with more of the Sanskrit words than he does, but in any case, I thought that these teachings or communicating this would help us read that book, and it would be a boon to our practice and understanding at a later date. That said, what I subsequently realized is that if I am going to further this introduction, I have to talk about one other subject that finds its roots in the Samdhi Nirmocana Sutra and also is expressed in the 30 verses. And that is a probably more difficult topic than these three transformations of mind. And this topic is called the three natures of phenomena. Noster goes, oh yeah. This is something that Reb Anderson talked probably for about 5 years about the three natures of phenomena. So I want to give a very brief introduction of those, so that when you, again, as I know you will, read Ben Colvin's book, you'll come across these phrases in there, and you'll have some idea. So the three natures of phenomena are the imaginary nature, it's also called the imputed nature of phenomena, the imaginary or the imputed nature of phenomena, the other dependent nature of phenomena, and the thoroughly established or the consummate nature of phenomena. So, the imaginary, the other dependent, and the thoroughly established. And this is what the lines on this particular subject in the 30 verses says about these three natures of phenomena. Whatever thing is conceptualized is of an imaginary nature. It does not exist. The other dependent nature is a conceptualization arising from conditions. The complete realized nature is the other dependent nature, always devoid of the imaginary. Now, I know the first time I heard this, my mind totally glazed over. And I would not be surprised if that is now fully in effect at this moment in this room.
What did you say?
Well, the verses, I can read the verses again. Whatever thing is conceptualized is of an imaginary nature. So this is the basic Yogacara teaching, right? We have an experience, we make an image in our mind, and then we, on top of that, we make a conception about the image. So this is the imaginary nature is this basic Yogacara teaching. We have sense experience, we make an image, we conceptualize that image. The other dependent nature is a conceptualization. So this is very interesting, right? So the other dependent nature is dependent co-arising. nothing new here, nothing you never heard before. Hopefully you have heard this, the teaching of dependent co-arising, many times in many settings. But you may not have heard that the other dependent nature is a conceptualization arising from conditions. You've probably heard about the conditions part, but not the conceptualization. So this is a little different teaching than... Uh-oh, there's a question.
Yes.
You need the mic.
I hate the mic.
Well, that's all right. You're doing good for your fellow...
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. The other dependent nature, if it is conceptualized, means it is imaginary as well. Is that correct?
It's under the sway of the imaginary, but it is not imaginary itself. So we'll get into that.
I hope so.
This is a very difficult teaching, and it will challenge me to make sense of it for you. So the third nature phenomena is the realized nature, which is the other dependent nature, not under the sway of the imaginary. So when I was sitting tonight and I was thinking about this, or it popped up to me that the thoroughly established nature is an immaculate conception. But I've been studying this stuff for weeks, so that seems really funny to me. But and it seemed really true, too. It seemed really true. But anyway, let me go back. Let me go back, because I'm getting way ahead here. So I know it's really, difficult to think, that the nature of phenomena is something that we really need to... need to understand, is in any way going to help us in our practice, or help us, in life, or in our interactions with daughters and other people, because we experience our suffering rather viscerally, We don't tend to think that our suffering is the result of a misconception of phenomena. We don't look at it that way. So, in a sense, this is a very detached kind of teaching, right? It's a teaching that's actually asking us to turn our attention towards how we are conceptualizing our experience. We turn our attention towards the stories we're telling ourselves about our experience. We're just having some experience, like somebody, says something really harsh to us. So the first thing is that we have an emotional reaction. But if we were, a Buddhist philosopher. If a Buddhist philosopher would hear, like the Buddhist philosopher sitting over there heard a tone in her voice. She heard a certain kind of tone in her voice, and on reflection, she heard this tone, and she had a kind of other dependent conceptualization about the tone. When she said the words, she might have been stuck in the in the imaginary nature of phenomena. But then she kind of had an experience of the other dependent nature of phenomena and was able to, you know, have some change in attitude as a result of that. So, this is, you know, very, very difficult teaching, and I can't do it justice like my teacher did it justice for many years, and he took many years to talk to us about this until our minds were no longer glazed over and we could actually kind of hear and appreciate these teachings. But as we've been saying, you know, we've been saying that the Yogacara is interested in how we know, you know, how we know what we know. And these three natures of phenomena are, again, teaching us how we know what we know. And so the first nature of phenomena, the imaginary nature of phenomena, is basically what the Yogacara is saying, folks, this is where you're stuck. You're stuck. In all you sentient beings are stuck in the imaginary nature of phenomena. Wake up! So according to the teaching of the Yogacara, we have sense experience. An image of that sense experience appears in the mind. And then we conceptualize that experience and we assign words and labels to that.
In what the process you just described,
yeah.
Could you attribute these three natures to those steps? Did I repeat it?
Yeah.
The process that you've just described of cognition.
Mm-hmm.
Can you ascribe the three natures of phenomena to the different steps which you have?
No. No.
Thank you.
No. No, that's just one nature of phenomena and how it works. So, according to this school. So, imaginary nature involves an image. Imagine image, an image in the mind, and then words and language and conceptualization around that image, which effectively makes us twice removed from actual experience. We are twice distant from actual what's going on. So let me finish with. So I wanted to bring this into a concrete analogy. And last time I talked about this story that Zuki Roshi told about hearing a blue jay. Do you remember this story? I read this story about him hearing a blue jay outside the Zendo. And when we hear a blue jay, we're sitting in the Tassajara, this is Zuki Roshi, or me, sitting in the Tassajara Zendo, and we hear a blue jay, and then we immediately start some mental process, and we imagine there's a bird. It's a blue jay. It's in a certain location. It's in a tree. I think I know which tree. Oh, where did I leave my lunch? Because the blue jay is coming for it. And then we start to worry about our lunch. And so this is the kind of, you know, Zuki Roshi talked about the blue jay and our relationship to the blue jay, which can be, you know, we don't like the sound of the blue jay. We do like the sound of the blue jay. We're worried about the blue jay and what it's going to do to my lunch, you know, and all this kind of thing. So this is, you know, there's a phenomena happening called a blue jay calling, or there's this noise. There's this noise happening, and then we make up stories about it. We make up an image of it. We can actually see the blue jay, and then we make up a story about what the blue jay is going to do, or we make up a story about how we feel about the blue jay. That you know, the blue jay doesn't have a sound that we necessarily like, and so forth.
Suzuki said it's sound that we make it a noise with the conceptualization. You use the word noise, that it's a noise, mm-hmm. but it's actually sound.
Right.
And that the conceptual mind makes it noise.
Right.
Something other than, you know, that's something separate from what's perceiving the sound.
Right. Clem. Clem's been waiting for a while. Get in on the action.
When you were talking about suffering, where does, like, physical pain come into all of this? Because it does, when I experience it, it does not seem to be 2 degrees removed. And my mind does not wander. And it seems to be rather immediate and direct.
Well, pain is already a description, you know. Pain is already a conceptualization. The imaginative process, when you say pain, the imaginative process has already begun to work. It's already involved. It's already in motion.
But that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about the pain.
I mean, I can discriminate between.
But there's already a conceptualization.
A
yes, you can. You can definitely discriminate. You have the power of discrimination. Congratulations, you're a sentient being.
Yes, but I never mistake one for the other.
Right. But you know, but pain is not always the same, right? What you call pain is not always, anyway, you can give a lot of different examples of this, but if you're in a certain situation where there's some quite a big distraction, pain is not the same as pain was before. Once when I was young, I went to the dentist, and this was a new age dentist type of person, and he went around in the world in a dentist bus. He had a dentist bus, and he didn't believe in anesthetic. And so he said, you know, just put on these headphones, and I'm going to turn up the music, and I'm going to drill your cavity out. And I kind of believed him. I don't know why, but I did. I think this will work. So I put on the headphones, and he turned it up, and I got involved in the music, and I had my cavity drilled out, and it wasn't painful. So pain isn't always pain. Pain isn't always the same. You contribute a lot to sensation with your consciousness, with mind consciousness.
Pain has an emotional component.
And pain has an emotional component.
I mean, that's what hurts. Okay? You have the sensation that your body doesn't care.
There's a big element of, this shouldn't be happening to me, usually. This is unfair. This is wrong. Why me? There's usually a huge component of that in there. Peter?
Certainly. I had a bike crash 2 days ago, and
I saw that. I'm sorry.
I have some lacerations on my scalp, and if I were to think there could be an infection back there, that fear, which I can't distinguish really from the sensation of the pain, enhances the pain. I would just say it's impossible to distinguish sensation from fear, and so there's always that emotional component that's been mentioned, and I know it's there, and I know I can't distinguish the two. There's, you know, if I have a pain in my gut, oh my goodness, do I have a splenic carcinoma? All sorts of, you know, concerns that causes more pain.
Well, there are anesthetics that eliminate the emotional part, and you feel the sensation, but it doesn't bother you.
Right.
The sensation is there.
Right.
You don't care.
I think, like, actually, pain is real, but what actually changed is the subjective intensity of the pain.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, because people can have different kind of pains, but how we're going to react to the pain, that can make that pain even worse or it can be lesser. But basically, by definition, pain is real, because actually our body is going to sense the pain and has been created like a system to check for inflammation, for pain. It's a system ingrained in our body to basically to look for something. But what really changed is the intensity or the way that we react to the pain.
So you know, this, a lot of meditators have had this experience. People, especially that go on long retreats, when you go on a long retreat and it always involves a certain amount of pain, and sometimes a lot of pain, especially if you sit cross-legged. And if you sit cross-legged, as I was able to do as a young man, I was able to sit long periods for cross-legged sitting, and it would become excruciatingly painful, and then it would change, and many people who have meditated have been involved in meditation for years have had this experience of sitting with the pain, and then suddenly it's not a problem. Exactly, thank you. It's not a problem. It's not an issue. It's not something about the nature of it for you, the subjective experience for you, changed. So it's not a fixed thing. It's, you know. So anyway, this is the imaginary nature. And like I say, according to the Yogacara, we're basically, this is where we are as sentient beings. Where we are as practitioners, as students of the Buddha way, is we are encouraged to encounter or meditate on the other dependent nature of phenomena. How no single entity has an essence, has nothing, as Myo is constantly, we've heard this teaching many, many times here, right? Myo likes to express it like the Tibetans. Nothing exists from its own side. Nothing exists from its own side. Everything that is as a result of a cause. Nothing has its own essence. So, you know, I was thinking about this. I will claim this is an original insight, okay? I was thinking about these three natures of phenomena. I think the imaginary nature of phenomena is associated with suffering. The dependent nature, the other dependent nature of phenomena, the co-arisen nature of phenomena, is associated with practice. This is what Buddhist meditators are to make the subject of their meditation. And then finally, we have the thoroughly established nature of phenomena, and it is associated with realization. It is associated with realization, and this is what, I've kind of skipped over all my notes. But this is what the Buddha says about the thoroughly established character in the Samdhi Nirmocana Sutra. It is the suchness of phenomena through diligence and through proper mental application, i.e., Zazen or insight meditation. Bodhisattvas establish realization and cultivation, through diligence and through proper mental application, bodhisattvas establish realization and cultivate realization of the thoroughly established character. This is what establishes all the stages up to unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. The third character of phenomena is the ultimate character. The ultimate character of phenomena is, according to the sutra, this is a wonderful statement. The ultimate character of phenomena is an object of observation for purification. I brought that up several times in the morning study group. An object of observation for purification. Apparently, we can observe the other dependent in a way that is free of the imputational. In stillness and silence, apparently, we have, bodhisattvas anyway, have the capacity to observe the other dependent completely free of this imaginary nature of phenomena. So this is the realm of non-thinking. This is the realm of sitting completely still, letting your life come to you, receiving your life just as it is. Pain coming, pleasures coming, whatever's coming, we're just letting it come and come and come. And when we're able to let everything come, it's like Tsuki Roshi said, the blue jay comes right into your heart, and the blue jay is reading the book, or sitting zazen, or working on the grounds. This is the moment of realization of suchness. Such a beautiful story from Suzuki Roshi. Yeah.
And so that process is, you wouldn't call that a recontextualization of phenomena, or would you?
Recontextualization. Well, I wouldn't be opposed to that. Say more about what you were thinking when you say that.
Well, you have the imaginary phenomena, and you have the codependent, is it, phenomena?
The other dependent.
Other dependent. They're probably codependent, too.
The co-arisen.
Co-arisen.
Yeah.
And through that process, though, as you say, with the final step in meditation, to let all of that come through a sense of realization, experiencing a realization, is that not any different than the mind recontextualizing what previously was imagination or dependent origination?
Well, I would say, yes, I would say the mind is recontextualized. That's what I would say. But we don't do that. You know,
so the result is the recontextualization. It isn't recontextualizing going on.
It's like we're not doing some recontextualization, but our relationship, whatever we are, to you know, the phenomena has changed. Yeah, well, transformation, yes. Recontextualization. We are experiencing phenomena differently And, you know, the teaching is that we, you know, even though we are, suffering human beings are, you know, stuck in this imaginary nature. We're stuck in conceptualization. We're stuck in this image making and story making based on the image making. The teaching is that in meditation, in our practice of sitting meditation, we can have a direct experience. We can have a direct experience. But this is, we need to practice to open ourselves to direct experience. Because the other dependent is the way things are. Okay? The other dependent co-arising is the way things are. But it's obscured. Dependent co-arising is always, and really, except in enlightenment, is obscured by the imaginary, by conceptualization. It's the image that the Samdhinir Mochana Sutra says, the other dependent is like a very clear crystal. But when you put the color red behind the very clear crystal, the crystal, you mistake the crystal for a ruby, and you think it's a ruby. And if you put the color blue behind the very clear crystal, you think it's a sapphire. And then it says something like, and you are deluded, and sentient beings are deluded. Each color that's put behind the very clear crystal. And he describes that, and then he says, "And sentient beings are deluded." So this is our situation. The other dependent is the way everything is happening, but it's obscured by the colors that we impute to it, whether they be, and we mistake the other dependent for something that it is not, which is a self. We think there's a ruby there, there's a sapphire there, there's something we can conceptualize and call something, but it's just like what's really there is just clear. You know, you can't even see it. So yeah, I think that's. Oh, look at me! I finally ended on time for once. You know, so I think that's most of what I wanted to say. Not quite in the order I was going to say it, but I think I got most of the points out. So that when you at the beach this summer with the Vasubandhu's 30 verses, you will read these three natures of phenomena. You remember. Maybe remember this talk, and it will potentially help your getting your arms around that. I think Ben Colvin, I haven't read the whole book myself yet. I've been so focused on the roots of these teachings, which is the Samdhinir Mochana Sutra, which is, you know, very not easy. And if you also, I wanted to mention that if you do want to explore that sutra, well, first of all, you can get the sutra, but also a little easier than that, although not much, is to get Reb Anderson's book called The Third Turning of the Wheel. And as Oscar and I have discussed, this is not, the editors of this book could have done a better job. Because it kind of tries to straddle the line between a kind of scholarly book and a kind of Dharma book, and it sort of doesn't land on either one, and it kind of one second it's like a Dharma book, and another second it's then you then it's more like a scholarly book, and it's a little muddled. But if you persist with it, which finally, because of my decision to offer these lectures, I persisted with it after having it on my shelf for several years, actually. And I still haven't read the whole of that either, did find it quite compelling, actually, when I was, in a sense, you know, compelled to read it. And I did find it quite compelling. And I want to give another talk sometime this summer about the teachings. I thought I was going to maybe get it into these lectures, but it just isn't going to work, obviously, about the teachings on shamatha, calming practice, and vipassana, which are in that sutra, and the whole chapter in the Samdhi-Nirmocana Sutra, and an excellent commentary in that part of it by Reb. And so I want to give a talk on that this summer and bring that out too. Didn't quite fit into these lectures. Raphael, you had a question. Do you have a mic?
Raphael is my name. Perceptual is certainly something very real taking place with the mind, just like the perspective is very real. But it almost want to distinguish between what the brain is telling me and what the mind is telling me, because there is a difference. Whether it's physical or whether it's emotional, there is a difference. But for me, it's always been very real, the two of them, what the brain is experiencing and what the mind is experiencing. And so it's certainly an opportunity to be able to distinguish and maybe discriminate, and certainly to be aware of how the mind can come up with these perceptuals that may not be something that's very real. And here I want to make a distinction: what's real from the imagined. And so I want to be able to see the effects of the imagined and the real, and then be able to sit with it a little bit more.
That's a very appropriate type of discrimination, to discriminate the real from the imagined. The direction of practice is to move from the imaginary nature, the karmically unwise momentum of our life, toward the karmically wise momentum of our life, transform the alaya, and move towards what is real, which is just things as they are, direct perception, things as they are. How are things as they are coming? How are we receiving them? Can we receive them so graciously, you know, so happily, so willingly? What's coming to us?
And the thing of pain, what I've ascribed pain to be, and how that really looks from the perceptual, and then the suffering from the perceptual, how that looks in in the real or the imagined. For me, the real is imagined, or the imagined is real. And that's what I've lived my life out of. That's the tip that I've lived out of. The imagined has become real. And I have not been able to distinguish the two because they're very real. And the opportunity for the mind to have a second look is something that's going to be very special for me.
Let's all take a second look. Thank you very much.